Greetings, shopmates, and welcome to Tinkering Bells, a show about DIY, design, and all things hands-on. The sky's the limit as we talk props, metalwork, cosplay, woodwork, leather, electronics, and so much more. I'm Tamara Robertson, your host, so strap on your tool belts because we're about to get into some skill sharing, y'all. Today, I'm going to be joined by a maker who's let curiosity be her guide, resulting in a diverse set of skills. I don't want to give away too much, but this maker literally traveled across the U.S. to get her first experience in carpentry and then continued around the globe to learn to stick well. If that doesn't make you want to stick around and hear more, you might be at the wrong podcast. Let's go ahead and have our tech talk of the day. So we're going to be talking about stick welding, which isn't always well known by cross-functional makers. So let's back it up and learn the basics. To answer the question, where did stick welding get its start? As you might imagine, welding has been around for quite some time. Welding has existed in some form or another as far back as the Iron Age and Bronze Age. There's evidence that the Egyptians learned to weld iron together, and historians have found small gold boxes with lap joints that are pressure welded from over 2,000 years ago. These welding styles were rudimentary at best, and it won't be until the 19th century that we start to see the conventional welding that we know start to appear. Stick welding, also known as shielded metal arc welding, is one of the easiest and most common types of welding. The electrode or stick that gives this type of welding its name is covered with a metal coating that melts and forms a gas shield as the heat is applied, adding slag, deodorizers, and alloy to the welded metal. Stick welding was first invented in Russia in 1888, involving a bare metal rod with no flux coating to give a protective gas shield. Now, the coated electrodes would not be developed until the 1900s, with the invention of the Kjellberg process in Sweden and the quasi-arc method in the UK. It's worth noting, though, that the electrodes were slow to be adopted because of their higher cost. But eventually, due to the need to ensure that welds were sound, they were adopted fully. Stick welding is pretty advantageous because it can be done in all positions. You can be laying flat, horizontal, vertical, and you can even weld overhead. It also has a low sensitivity to drafts, which enables it to be utilized outdoors, which you don't find with most other forms of welding. The drawbacks, though, include the slag, which is produced and needs to be chipped off the weld once the weld run is complete, short lengths of welding due to the length of the electrodes limiting the process, and the weld penetration itself being low. So you can work with different coating types and thicknesses of the electrode to change some of these items. Stick welding remains one of the most versatile types of welding and is used in numerous fields today, including construction, shipbuilding, the petroleum industry, field repairs, manufacturing, mining, steel fabrication, and structural welding. I even use it on Mythbusters when I'm having to fix something in the field. Well, that's it for your tech talk. As always, you can join in on the conversation with my maker friends and me on the Tinkering Bells Instagram and Twitter pages. Just search for Bells Tinkering, hit follow, and share your DIY adventures together with us. Have a tool you want to learn about? Let me know, and it might be featured in a future episode. Tell us what you liked, what you hated, or possibly even what we missed. So now we're going to be getting into the main event, and I'm so excited to introduce you to our next maker. So drum roll, please. Presenting Mary. Thanks for joining me. How are you?
I'm well. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited. I've really been looking forward to this. But to start, I want the audience to know, like, where should they go to find you if they want to, like, follow you? And what could they expect to see if they go there?
I don't have a super prominent virtual presence, but I do have an Insta that's primarily personal. But because I do live a maker-oriented lifestyle, on that personal account, you do see some of the things that I'm up to and that I'm conjuring up into reality. And so that is at Sappy Spice on Instagram. Beyond that, I lay pretty low.
I think Lainey said this well. We got to meet twice for the first time. So we actually met at WorkbenchCon, which I'll let you tell that one because I seem to not recall it as well.
That feels like a really good endorsement for WorkbenchCon as an aside. But yeah, it was their second year, so February 2019. Yeah. And I can say that leading up to it, I was feeling a little bit isolated in my corner of the world, which is Oklahoma, USA. And just through the awareness of makers that I have at large, you know, it was would have been very difficult to ignore that event coming up. And so I made a decided effort to attend that. And you're kind of distinct. You're a little recognizable. And so I saw you as the days were going by. I'd eclipse you on the escalators, going in between panels. And I want to say that the first less recalled meeting was in the presence of Craig Cowan.
Oh, yeah.
And for those of you that know him, you know him.
And those of you that don't should probably head over to the Makers Happy Hour podcast and check it out. And you will know more about Craig than you ever wanted to.
Yes. Well put. So I think that often I was seeing you by his side and there would have been like an elevation difference between his stature and yours. But yeah, you definitely had like a spunky aura about you. And I think that we probably wound up visiting at Barside. Craig and I were engaged in talking about like opal mining or some super tangential thing. And because you and him had kindled a friendship, you by proxy came into the equation. But yeah, I didn't get to know you as directly or as personally at that stage as I would wind up having the opportunity to later on in the Catskills at that making event.
Which was really cool. So we got to meet the second time and actually more directly like meet and hang out and like really get to like kind of find out who each other were as makers. And like we had this little tripod. It was like me, you and Lainey. And then Craig would like jump in anytime he could. But like, I remember, you know, Pat Reynolds picked me up at the train station. I took the train from New York City to the Catskills and he picked me up and he's like, we're going to head back into the city tomorrow and we're going to be picking up Pine and Birch and we'll be picking up Sappy Spice and we'll be picking up Press Crow. And I'm like, okay, I don't know any of those people. I don't know the names, you know?
Oh, I was like, that's comical that you're saying that. I was going to, because you know, they're heavy hitters. They do participate in the social media world. And so it's so funny to hear my name in that same string. But golly, Pat Reynolds, man, I met him. I'm sorry to derail here, but it feels worth making a point to say, as far as good characters go, I got to meet him whenever I did one of the knife making workshops at Duresta's, which again, in that vein of where I was just personally, whenever I teed myself up to attend WorkbenchCon, I also was like, I've got to go to one of these Duresta workshops. Knife making seems cool while I was perusing the options. And so that had a nice fluidity as far as February was the WorkbenchCon in Atlanta. And then I think it was April of that same spring, 2019, to then have a separate endeavor to go and kick it in upstate at, you know, the Duresta compound. And if you watch any of Jimmy's stories, especially at that point in time, Pat was a regular figure helping him get the big barn shop wired up. And so I, you know, made it up to the workshop, was getting to know everybody. And lo and behold, Pat rocks up because he, in between working in the city, he likes to spend his time seeing what the heck's going on in Jimmy's world and visiting with the workshoppers when he can. He's a very social kind of guy and he really embodies the spirit of skill sharing and kind of uplifting others. And so I met him just because I happened to be going to that workshop and he was very, I think he was kind of amused that there was just this girl rolling solo from Oklahoma, like a little bit, you know, what the hell are you doing here? But also like, hey, you're gonna, I also planned this trip where I would be able to mosey about the city with a friend of mine that lives there and like mooch off of his accommodations. And so Pat insisted, he's like, you need to come see me at work. I'll show you around the place. And the place that he showed me around was, you know, the new World Trade Center and with the affiliation he had with Condé Nast there, got me this inside tour that's just, you know, I got to show photos to my carpentry instructor from a decade ago. And it's like, hey, look at this rat bag on this very prestigious job site. It was great. But anyway, Pat and I had this meeting then at Jimmy's, and then I followed up on it while I was in the city, took me around. I think he got a lot of joy out of that. I got a lot of joy out of that. And a few months later, he was checking in on me because we stayed in contact, and he was really adamant that I make it to the Catskills. And so he went out of his way to kind of make sure that I prioritize that. And he even helped as far as some of the just nuts and bolts of, okay, where are you flying in and how can I help with the transport stuff? So that's how the hell I even was in that same string of handles of Pine and Birch and, you know, Jess Crow and then in the likes of yourself, where I wouldn't have really had any business otherwise. But fortunately, he has a pretty good character radar. And so as like kind of tired as I was to be arriving when I was arriving and a little bit out of my element, it was immediately just like a series of hilarious moments and mishaps.
It was so great. So I met Pat at Spring Make, where I was keynoting, and he was, you know, he was palling around with Jimmy at the time, and Jimmy was also keynoting, and it was kind of my first time getting to know Jimmy and a lot of the makers. And Pat and I ended up talking like for hours one night after the event about my STEM outreach comic that I was just in ideation form, trying to figure out like, how do I get this to kids that don't have internet? Like, how do I find out a way to get this into libraries and all this stuff? And he is just one of the brightest lights that I've ever met. Like, he's like, I want to introduce you to these people. Like, we should talk to these people. You should try this. Like, just such an idea guy. And it's just so amazing because he's so invested in the Catskills. Like, he just really wants that place to like become a maker's mecca, just like Jimmy does. And so it was like great, because then he's like, hey, we're going to do this Catskills Maker Camp. Like, you should come. It's going to be amazing. And he did the same thing with me. He helped me like figure out what does this look like, because I was actually at New York Comic Con speaking for the week before. So I'm like, look, I'm already flying in for this. I'm going to be at, you know, downtown for these hotels. And then I got to transition up. Like, what does that look like? Do I have to get an Uber? I really don't want to rent a car in the city. And he's like, oh no, you just get on this train. It's super easy. It drops you right to me. And so like, I was really excited just to like hang out with Pat again. And then he's like, hey, we're going to go pick up these girls. And I'm like, Pat, I was like, I don't think I packed warm enough clothes for the Catskills. Can we go somewhere that I can buy like some thermals? And he's like, yeah, we'll do that. And so then we're there and I find these like really awesome, like fuzzy socks. And I'm like, hey Pat, we're going to be around a campfire, right? What if I got all the girls fuzzy socks? And he's like, I think that's a great idea. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't follow them or know them yet. So like, what kind of colors do you think they like? And we were like sitting there, he's like telling me each of your personalities. And I'm like choosing based on all of those. And then it's great, cause you guys like each one by one, we picked you guys up, and like Pat brought us back to the house, and his wife and his kids were there, and they like gave us beers, and we like ate sandwiches. And it was like, do you remember we took the picture on the steps? Like the old,
yes, yes, very reminiscent of a winter formal, if you will. Yes,
it was so great. Like, I just, that was such a fun trip. Like, and yes, for that to be like the end of 2019 and like right before I went into like hermit mode to like work on a bunch of projects, and then thought I would get to come out of it in February and instead got told, no, you get to stay in that because this is what we're at. Like, it's funny that you talk about like the makers like that were in the car with us and not knowing them. And like now, obviously we know Lainey, we know Jess, like we all became like so close over that like short amount of time, which is still incredible to me when I think about like how much, you know, how many memories we built in such a short amount of time together.
Rapid fire inside jokes. I mean, yes, we were just turning them up.
I still have the shirt design. So the next time that we are all together, like shirts will be printed. They are coming. Like I am just waiting for like the day that I can be like, okay, I'm getting on a plane like in a month. What size is everyone? Let's get some
Yes,
t-shirts.
bring it on.
But like I, you know, that the event that you met me at, the reason why I was with Craig the entire time is because one, I had literally just met Craig. Craig started heckling me like 2 weeks before Workbench Con. And he's like, how can you be a maker if you don't know about this con? And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about. Who are you? What's going on? And he heckled me into going. And I literally like, I flew from California to Georgia to meet up with some random person from the internet because they said it was a good idea. And it was great because we met a day early and we hung out at the Georgia Aquarium and we like drank beers surrounded by little kids and laughed about that. And then
Timeless.
he walked me around and introduced me to like everyone, you know, because I didn't know who he was. He introduced me to Jimmy. I didn't know who Jimmy was.
You didn't
I
know
was
who
at
Jimmy was
Workbench
going into
Con.
that. That's
No, because
funny.
I just don't. So it's funny. YouTube for me is where I go now that I own a Honda Element to learn how to do all of the things I learned how to do repair wise on a Chevy. You know, so like when I need to change my spark plugs, I go to YouTube. Like I had no idea up until Workbench Con that YouTube was like a thing people did for a living. Or that it was something that I could actually get entertainment from. You know, so
Sure.
it was like one of those things that afterwards I went back and I subscribed to like channels of everyone that I met and I sat down and like watched whatever videos it would like put on the main screen and like got to know, you know, the people that I had met. And I'm like, oh, everyone's, yeah, they're, I have no idea who anyone is and I'm okay with that, but this is awesome. These people are really awesome, you know? And what I liked about it too, though, is that I mean, even now, I still like, I feel like every time I go, I meet new makers that I have no idea who they are. And I love it because I just add more credible making to my like Instagram feed to look at. It's like great, right? But yeah, I like it. I like that aspect of it. I kind of actually like that I went into the first one having no idea who anyone was. Like,
Yes, I don't have any critique on that. I think there's some value at coming in really receptive or kind of unclouded and just sort of there for the ride. Whoever wants to make an impression makes an impression, but you don't have any star-struckedness to necessarily distract you from what's alluring at the event. I think that's a perfectly great way to arrive.
yeah, you just walk up to everyone, which you know, I mean, you know, Craig. Craig literally walks up to everyone. And then, like, I'm so little and just like, I'll just talk. I literally will talk to a wall. Like, I'm 5 foot southern. Like, even if it doesn't talk back, I'm gonna have a full conversation. You know, so I just had so much fun kind of just bouncing around. And you know me, like, I'm an open book, but like, there's chapters of the book that like, you know, people like Lainey and you and Jess like and Zyla, you guys got to know and Tracy, like, but like, you know, there's parts of me that are mine, you know, too. Yeah. So for the most part, open book. But so speaking of that, like that friendship, that like that part of you that you divulge like to your friends that they know you, but other people might not know. And especially because you are, you know, you're not in the mainstream, like you're not making YouTube content around what you do. How would one of your closest friends like describe what you do for a living?
Oh gosh. I don't know because I'm reluctant to even describe it myself, you know, and I'm the one that has the closest proximity. My friends have been privy to my various educational endeavors, you know, and that started to take off formally in 2010. I did a 2-year carpentry program in my hometown. And in high school, I had already always intended to do the like university route, blah, blah, blah. And things kind of changed in what would have been like the summer before the freshman year in that paradigm. And I'd been able to do a little bit of traveling and just reevaluated and decided that getting a skill set in my back pocket and not encumbering student loans felt more enticing. And Oklahoma, at the very least, and I suspect other states have a similar program, offer something called a Next Step Scholarship, where within like 2 years out of high school, if you had like a C GPA or above that, your vocational program is going to be free. And so even though I was only 18 at the time, I could recognize how indispensable it could be to just get a competency. And whether that was going to be the vocation that I stayed with for the rest of my life or not, it would at least give me a little bit of structure and keep me out of trouble. And I don't have any glamorous origin story of like my grandfather was a carpenter or anything like that, but there was a seat that was available in the carpentry class and it appealed to me enough to attend the first day. And then the instructor and I immediately struck it off really well. And so I continued to show up and then enrolled for the second year of finished carpentry and then found work in custom cabinet shops upon completion of that program. But I went into it just pretty open and then quickly learned that some of the discord that I had with like public education, again, at least in middle America, was alleviated by that experience-based setting. Getting to go into the shop and be hands-on and make mistakes to break away from the textbook-heavy curriculum and really have an applied lesson, that stuck. And so, again, my peers were aware of that endeavor whenever I was a late teenager, and then my peers were aware of me working in cabinet shops. And then my peers are aware now that it's 10 years later, and among all the cabinet shops I was kicking around in, several of them had CNC machines running all the time, making box parts or doing more complex engraving and this and that. And so steadily, the automation stuff was kind of, there was a seed sown for me there just from what I'd witnessed as an employee in certain spaces. But then coupling that with watching some of the makers, you know, on social media and seeing like them jump on a mill to surface something or get on a lathe and make custom threads, it's like, golly, like machining could be a nice little complimentary thing here. And I was reflecting on how positive that vocational experience was with the carpentry program. And so last January, I entered as a part-time student, I entered this machining program here in Oklahoma City. Again, not necessarily because I'm trying to be a career machinist, but because I'm drawn to being able to have more feathers in my cap for problem solving and to just be able to interact with people that are identified as career machinists and to have a little bit of a language to communicate with them. A lot of my experience in construction or in trades has been really positive as far as just like learning how to ask questions, like deciphering what you don't know and what you need to know, like knowing what you don't know that you need to know and being able to approach that. I don't have to be a plumber, but if I can shoot the shit over what, you know, a rough-end valve is, I'm going to get that much better answers at the counter of the supply store, you know, with whatever particular aspect I'm trying to get remedied. And maybe have peace of mind that if I have to farm something out, potentially it'll be done with a decent standard, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Like learning that vernacular really just empowers you. You know, it's something that my parents are both military, but my dad like basically used to run his own motorcycle shop and like always worked as a mechanic. And he taught me how to work on a car and how to change anything on a car, how to rebuild engines. And just in learning the actual vernacular that's used in a shop, that's used by auto mechanics, like I can go in to get something done. And like, I have the option to do it myself if I need to, but I can also go in and get something done and have a discussion with the mechanic on an equals standpoint. You know, I don't have to worry that they're going to put me through the ringer or I'm going to get taken advantage of because I'm empowered enough to be able to have a direct conversation with them and self-diagnose the problem going in and then have them as the expert confirm and fix, you know. And I
totally
I think there's a value to that. I did learn though, as you know, because I used to own a home in North Carolina, and within my first year of buying this brand new home, like the water heater shit out, which I was like, how does that even happen? And the guy came to repair it, and I was like leaning on the door jamb and like asking him lots of questions and using his vernacular, but like it got to a point where I could tell that he thought I was micromanaging and paying attention to make sure he didn't like dupe me. And I finally had to be like, I'm actually just really curious because I only have a base knowledge that I got from my dad, and you have a much more in-depth knowledge. So I thought I maybe could learn. But if
I'm gonna go ahead and comfortable,
I'm just gonna leave.
No, it is immensely valuable to share that vernacular, but there's some nuance in it, and I totally agree. And just as a person that like has done remodels and like been in other people's private spaces, I take that really seriously. And as much as there might be, you know, disadvantages to being a female in this space, 79 cents on the dollar, for instance, as much as there might be inherent kind of labeling or these subtleties that are just a part of the game, one of the many advantages, because I also believe that there are plenty of advantages that exist of being a female, is that I think whenever I am in somebody's space, especially if it's family, if there's kids in the mix, I think they're a lot more at ease having a young woman in their home than some, you know, archetypical mustachioed whatever. There's an opportunity to actually create a sense of comfort and safety with my presence, provided I have the confidence to conduct whatever, you know, service is necessary in that sense. But to the point of this plumber and the water heater example, in that vernacular piece, one thing that I really get immense joy from is the unification element of just sharing this common ground that we both like work, and that if I can convey a reverence for their aptitude, you know, I don't have to know everything they know, but I can show appreciation for their competencies. And that really excites me. You know, I think gratitude is a really powerful currency. And so that also informs how curiosity driven my decision making is. The more I learn, the more I can relate to others. And I think being a self-identified sheepdog, kind of going against the cultural grain or trends, if you will, and then also remember Middle America, Oklahoma, growing up, and I'm sure plenty of my ideologies and lifestyles don't fit into the pattern, but picking up some of the skills that I have, I found that I can like totally get along with people that on paper I would have no business palling around with. But at some point, that doesn't have to matter. And we can have a mutually shared goal, or again, tap into this reverence piece, or I can find something to be grateful for. I don't need, it doesn't become necessary or relevant who you voted for if you can help me achieve, you know, solution making. Mm-hmm. And so that super holds my interest as far as moving in within this makerspace. And that's also where it's really joyful to go to some of these events too, and feel that kind of collective camaraderie of just knowing that like, oh yeah, there's like a similar RNA among us, that like we are similarly aligned to, you know, ask the questions and then have find solutions, solve problems with the materials and the tool manipulation.
Yeah, and that inherent curiosity, which you keep coming back to, like that, the coolest thing about these events and the people within the maker community is that we are all freaking curious. Like if we're not the expert in it, like we're not gonna be like, I don't like you because you're the expert. No, we'll be like, oh dude, how do you do that? What is that? Can you show me? Like, can you do it again so I can see it again? You know?
Yes. It doesn't have to be competitive.
Yeah. That excitement, that curiosity, I think is what really like drives me, like with projects. It's like, I want most of the things I do, it's because like, I've never done that before. Let me go and do it huge for some reason. Like I'm never like, let me try it small. Then I'm like, let me just do the biggest thing I can with that, you know? And I think it's something that just keeps you excited about it, you know? And so when you talk about this intersectionality that happens because of the love of making, Not just like within the US and within different peer groups, but also like you've gone abroad and you've gained building skills while you've been traveling as well. So can you speak a little bit about like the skills that you've acquired on the road and like what that was like, not only making in a new place with new types of people, but also like learning a skill where you may not have known like where to go and get materials or where to get the tools and things like that.
Yeah. So after that 2-year carpentry stint, flash forwarding in time to, well, going backwards and then moving forwards, I'll say, we're looking at like 2013. I lucked into a connection with this family in very, very rural Queensland, Australia, where they were living on a 200,000 acre station, and station is synonymous with ranch, might be a more familiar term here, where they were running lots and lots of sheep and cattle. And so being from Oklahoma, I'm like, yeah, I got family in Southwestern Oklahoma. They run cattle, they got wheat, they got peanuts, whatever. But this is a whole other magnitude. And just the topography is completely different. And there's so many kind of caveats to what it's like to do that thing there. And in the preliminary stages of getting that trip arranged and going into it really blind, it was real stinking close to being a cold call, but I had one common connection there, which was the sculptor that I apprenticed with while I was in my carpentry program. He'd stayed with his family and arranged for me to go out there because he thought it'd be a good experience. And so he advocated for me, but they didn't need to say yes, and they did. And that was really generous. And I think that made me feel, in light of being a little bit like, I think, anxious about, it was going to be my first time traveling internationally. Luckily, there wasn't going to be a language barrier, but boy, was there some, you know, hours between me and what was familiar to me by getting out there. Anyway, in these initial kind of introductory emails with them and kind of coordinating when exactly I should get there and where I should fly into, and what train station I should go, because mind you, I wound up flying into Brisbane, which is an international hub, but then got on a train and rode 13 hours due west inland. Like, it was wild. Wow. Beautiful train ride. And I got to see like the sunrise in the middle. It was a really interesting experience. But anyway, get picked up by this person I'd never met in flesh. It was the matron of the property. But I told them early on that, you know, I would love to get some time on the tractor. And I said that I'd been doing this carpentry thing and then I'm just ready to be put to work, kind of whatever chores need doing, I'm game. And it so happened that the father, husband on the property, he is like super mechanically minded. And you'll find that there are these different kind of personalities that steward the land. Some people are like super into the animal side and they're like animal whisperers. And then like, even though this family had a lot of the animals there and they had diversified income from that, this guy's jam was like getting machinery and restoring it and then using that to uplift the infrastructure of the property at large. And whenever you're on 200,000 acres, space isn't an issue. And because of the climate in Australia is so dry, as long as something is off the ground, like on a pallet or whatever, it's likely not going to rust. And so you don't necessarily need a lot of sheds. Over there, they have an equivalent to like a Lowe's or Home Depot called Miter 10. And so the running joke was that their scrapyard was called Miter 11. And so if we were making a repair, they'd be like, go check Miter 11, you know? So to your point around like, where do you go to get materials? It's like, you better hope you have something on hand because their driveway is 7 kilometers long and Quilpie, the nearest town that's 63 kilometers away, like doesn't have a lot of specialized resource. So environments that are that remote really promote self-reliance. And that super, super resonates with me. Again, this family was so willing to accommodate me just by the endorsement of our mutual connection, but it wasn't an irregular occurrence that they would have intrepid people passing through. And like, if you could change a motorbike tire, they were so excited to give you the biggest lamb chop, because there's always going to be kind of things that need servicing and chores to be done. And I, perhaps this is just my own projection, but I felt that at large, it seemed like the attitudes of the people in that part of the world were such that more of what we consider like a blue collar type of background is valued up there with the white collar stuff. It just seemed, there seemed like a much greater cultural appreciation of people who have those aptitudes. And I think that was really neat for me to be exposed to at 21 and feel like, oh man, you know, if you accumulate these things here and there, if you learn how to back up a trailer, and if you just steadily seize opportunities to get a little skill set and to be of value, and then that accumulates, and then you can be at a place in a moment and you can be that much more helpful. And again, just seeing how valued strangers could be. And just again, that sense of self-reliance is like, yeah, that's really going to inform me. That's really going to leave an impact on what my kind of compass or trajectory will be, is that I want to look for opportunities to gain knowledge and experience, and I want to relate to the people that have it.
And that's an incredible place to gain that kind of experience, right? Because like what you're talking about, these homesteads, like there's constant work, and like with you going in with this like go-getter, like I'll try anything, I want to do anything, like let me know how I can help. That's really incredible. And I think you were telling me that you actually learned how to stick weld while you're on the farm, because fencing, right? Like who doesn't need fencing when you have so many animals, right?
And I did forget about that piece. I don't know if anybody would be able to connect with the sense of how novel welding can seem whenever you haven't done it before, but especially for being somebody that's accustomed to slicing up wood, that like is even more compelling. Oh my gosh, manipulating metal, that's like so robust, and let's do this thing. So yeah, they, you know, stick welding behooves itself to being geared for outdoor projects, because you don't have to have the gas shield that you have with MIG. You know, you have that flux coating on your electrode. And I didn't know any of this shit at the time, but I knew that we have a trailer with a generator on it, and we're going to take that out to these cattle yards, and it's going to take an hour to get there because their property is huge and this is the yards that needs repairing. And it didn't have to be pretty. So that was like just for step one, as far as like being about to pull the trigger after watching, you know, watching the property owner show me what I needed to emulate. The stakes were a little lower just because it's only got to hold cows in. But yeah, I mean,
it's got to be strong to hold cows. I mean,
it's got to be strong, but it doesn't have to be some, you know, like auto body grade bead.
You don't have to have those crescent moons shining.
Exactly, exactly. There was some forgiveness, but I guess I shouldn't downplay the fact that cows are big beasts. You're not wrong there. So yeah, we had like, I think over two afternoons, we kind of updated these yards, and it was a scenario where you're packing all of your food for the day. And again, like I said, getting that trailer and staging everything out there. And the sun is, I mean, it's the same sun that you have anywhere else in the world, but there felt like there's something more majestic about that sun in the outback. And they took really seriously, as far as PPP goes, they were so vigilant about skin covering and like having long sleeves on and sunscreen. And I felt really cared for by how I would get reprimanded if I wasn't following it in suit. And one of the first things that they got for me was like my own hat, my own, Akubra is this brand out there that's like pure rabbit fur felt. And it's like, well, all the legit people that work the land there have. And so it was a very special gift that I still have to this day when they got me that cap. But it was also essential, just because everything is about like breaking the sun if you can, and working to those conditions and being aware of that, which you notice with anybody that's like really immersed or kind of specialized into their field. There's a lot of subtle things that that overtly a layman wouldn't recognize that they're doing to create longevity in their field and to also improve outcomes. And the sun protection thing was something that was really built into their lifestyle. So yeah, you know, those elements were in play because we were in the direct sunlight out there working on those yards. And I mean, I didn't take up close pictures at that time. Again, it was 2013. I think I didn't get an Instagram until 2017 or something. You know, I wasn't like too worried about capturing my first weld necessarily. I don't have photos. I'd probably be disheartened to look at them. But yeah, I got the principles of it, and it felt really great to be invited in on that. Just like it felt really great to be trusted with their trucks, which they call utes, you know, jump in the ute, and everything there was stick shift, but also diesel engines are really prevalent. So it seems to be that the torquiness with that setup means that you stall less. So it was a very forgiving situation to get more proficient with the manual transmission and driving the trailers and all of that. Yeah, so I think that was the biggest instance. Doing those yards over that 2-day period was like the most welding time that I had for a long while until actually around WorkbenchCon a couple of years ago, I decided to take an evening welding course, like a 30-hour thing. And at that stage, I was like, okay, stick was fine and all. Also frustrating because that electrode can stick to your material if you don't have the right finesse. I think I want to have a go at MIG welding. If any type of welding that I will want to introduce into the work I'm doing now, considering like finished carpentry and more furniture stuff and thinking about like bases and things that are more of that fixture grade, it would be MIG. And so that's what I really doubled down on later in life. But there's some really rugged utility in that stick application for sure.
Yeah, it's funny because I knew how to MIG, TIG, and oxyacetylene weld going into like my time with MythBusters. And I remember like, I think it was maybe our fourth episode, and we ended up going out into the field and our rig got broke. And I'm like, we need to weld this. Like, is there a way to get it indoors? And our like local fabricator guy who just, I mean, he's literally a welding beast. Like I would trust him. If I had to like be welded in something to save my life, he would be the person I would want welding it. He just kind of laughed at me. He's like, no, we're just going to stick weld it. It doesn't need to be pretty. And I'm like, I don't know what that means. Are you going to, he's gonna get a stick and you're what? And I was like, you can't weld outside. You gotta have the gases. You can't weld outside. He's like, you can stick weld outside. And so that was like the first time I ever saw a stick welder, the first time I ever welded a stick welder. And I was like, there's a lot of value in this. Like application wise, like being able to have that versatility to weld anywhere. It was just one of those things that I'm like, if someone's going to weld, they should learn to stick weld first.
Totally.
You know, because that sticking too is going to help you when you get to TIG.
Oh, it's going to make you, yeah. Well, with TIG, yeah. It made me really grateful to get onto MIG, but just again, to the point of the utility with the stick welding in Oklahoma, oil and gas is one of our prevailing industries. And so a lot of the tech welding programs drive hard with the stick stuff because that's what's going to get you employed and employed well. So yeah, I revisited it, but then I quickly, you know, was able to speak with the instructor and say what's going to serve me most, because I'm not trying to pal around with those good old boys necessarily more than just in this classroom space, is going to be jumping on the MIG. And definitely, I haven't really looked back, but it's really satisfying to know that there are things for the things, you know, what can we disseminate, what the application is, and then there's probably going to be an approach that will best serve it. However, another appeal to the making space is how many answers there are, and that one size doesn't fit all. At another point in my life, I was training jiu-jitsu for a while, and unfortunately I've been too good at making excuses recently to do that practice very regularly, but you'll find in that sport too that one size does not fit all, and a technique that works on with a smaller bodied person isn't going to be the same style that works with a bigger bodied person. And there's no just prescriptive answer on how to be successful. It's just whatever works best for you. And that's very much the case in making, like, what tools you have versus what tools I have are going to have variation. And what I'm most comfortable with that I can safely operate is also going to be different. That doesn't mean that we can't both produce a vanity, or that doesn't mean that we can't both do a thing, but it's very alluring to me how many different avenues there can be there. And we kind of touched on earlier, but I was sort of saying that sort of removes some of the competitive elements of other situations and endeavors, because there's just so many opportunities and variations on ways to do things. And I think that I just see myself being in this space forever because of that.
Yeah, I feel like you're always going to learn something new. Like, what we talked a little bit, just like offline, about like going home again, right? And so I've traveled the world doing relief work engineering wise. So I've learned a lot of those same things about when you're super remote and it's going to be days before you're near anyone that might have a tool, like how you plan ahead of times. But like recently I've been doing more relief work back home because I'm from North Carolina. They've been getting like hammered with hurricanes, and it's given me the ability to actually like go back and build with my dad in a totally different way. Because, you know, like I grew up as, you know, as the tool monkey for my dad, going whatever he needed, which by the way means that I don't know the proper names for most tools, because I was like four, like grabbing tools, and it was more descriptive terms than actual names, which still gets me in trouble in the shop today. But it's like this whole new set of eyes that I get to watch him with now, because like he's now seeing me as a maker for the first time in my own right, not just like not as an apprentice anymore that I'm just doing what he says, but instead he'll like be like, well, what approach would you take? And we have like this discussion, which is really kind of cool, because I'm like, you want to know what I would do? But then there's also, you know, what you were talking about, where artisans have these kind of life hacks and maker hacks that they don't even realize are hacks, because they've just been doing it so long that they know that that is the best way to do it, or they know that's the longevity way to do it. And so I love to just kind of sit back and watch my dad. And it's kind of funny because, you know, my dad's in his mid 70s. And so like time being what time is, every single time I'm with him, I'm just trying to like drink it all in. And so like, I've started like, I'll take out my phone and I'll like record how he does certain things. And then I'll just sit like after that trip at home and I'll like watch, because in the moment I want to be there with him, but then I want to also like learn and reflect and figure out, you know, like, why did you do this? And like ask him questions about it later. But it's so neat to me that like every builder I'm around, I learn something different from. Like I recently started watching, Jimmy did this series a while ago that was like shop tips and tricks. And it's like, he does things that just blow my mind. Like there was this one moment.
I'm pretty sure I know the series and it's quintessential.
It is like, I'm just sitting there watching. I'm like, all of this is so different than what I've ever seen, you know? Like, and one of the things that I like, and I told him this in person, I was like, Jimmy, I was like, you have no idea how much you changed my life simply by taking a paint roller and tapping it on the thing until the roller fell off. I was like, I literally get my hands covered in paint every time to remove that thing. And you just like the way you get ketchup out of a bottle by smacking it. He was just like, boop, boop, done. And I'm like, mind exploded. But like, that's the cool thing about being a maker. I feel like every single person I come in contact with is going to have some form of lesson for me to learn. Like, I don't think you ever stop being an apprentice in a way. Like, you do move to a point where you're kind of also a master and you can have apprentices. But like, I feel like I'm always going to be learning.
Well, and that's personally speaking, as far as like how I want to view myself, being in a world where everybody is my teacher is ideal. I love relating to others that way, where your default assumption is that they have something that you could glean from them. Perhaps that sounds really selfish, but I think there's a more kind of like squishy light in that. And yeah, it's beautiful. It's also really lovely that you have the presentness with your father to both relish this station that you're at right now, and then that you're getting a little bit of archives generated just because of the way time works. I think that's really wonderful. I share a similar rapport with my carpentry instructor. He's been immensely helpful while I've been remodeling my mom's place, which is one of those jobs that's just never going to end, partially because she's just really patient and is, you know, allowing for me to show up to other jobs and this and that. But it's been satisfying, the progress that I've made in these other areas. And I can just tell, partially because my carpentry instructor tells me, and partially because I'm not blind and I can see the look on his face, but whenever he's witnessing me come up with different solutions, or even just by the nature of the questions that I'm coming to him with, he's able to reference my growth in this space, and it's been really fun to share that. So I can relate to what you're describing with your father there.
I like that. I hope that, you know, young makers, like, that's the one experience I hope that they get to embrace and really enjoy. And I do worry sometimes because of how much of life now is phone and sharing and move on very quickly driven, that people will miss it. But I'm hoping they don't, you know, like, I'm hoping they take the time to be in the moment and to learn it and to see it. And I think most people that really want to make are the type of people that also really want to just
bingo. I mean, it's there for those who want to take it, and that's not going to diminish. The return is going to be as enriching as it ever is. And perhaps there's more, I'm remiss to even say distractions, because people that are, you know, more infatuated with these other technologies, so be it. Maybe they can be more innovative with them than I can be. My calling is one that has a little bit more of that tactile aspect in it, and just how my brain is and sensory wise and what's going to keep me stimulated. But for those who show up, it's going to be rewarding. I know one thing about just like my personality is that I, growing up, kind of had a little bit of trouble with authority, just because I would be asking questions and these same kind of curious things and that we touched on at the top. In this space, it's been really cool if, you know, I run something through the table saw and something about like how quickly I was pushing it or what my alignment on the fence was like, and like have really bad burn from where on the kerf side, and it's like, that has nothing to do with a teacher not liking you. It's like, you need to move faster. It depersonalizes it in this way that I think helps me not get really derailed and to exercise a type of maybe like critical thinking, where it can, again, not be about anything wrong with me personally, but diffusing it to being the static free feedback about what I need to do as an operator. And I've experienced so much growth internally by staying with projects. And like Jimmy's talked about, how do you grow as a maker? You back yourself into a corner and you work your way out. And I've just done that time and time again. I'm so glad I still have hair on my head, because I have been so very challenged in these different instances, and I've gotten so messy and I've gotten so exhausted and so sore. But the satisfaction to overcome something that's kicking my ass is unlike anything else. And so again, I have no doubts that level of salvation will be available to those that choose to pursue it.
I love it. This has been so like in depth and deep and just like enjoyable. And I hate that we're like coming up on the end. I want to do some rapid fire, because there are a couple things that I found while light internet stalking. that I did want to ask about. So you have in your description that you are inextinguishably staffing. What does that mean? What does that mean to the outsider that may not know exactly what other than sap being sticky goo that comes out of a tree, what that might mean?
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a small origin story with the sappy spice handle, and it is that I was framing out a basement suite or like kind of apartment situation. And for whatever reason, the lumber, that batch of lumber was super sappy. And the guy working with me, we're laughing about it. And like, we'd just be like in a doorway or putting a header up and then like, what the hell on my shoulder? And like, that is the sap again. And then at dinner, the discussion was like, if you were a Spice Girl, which one would you be? And the same character would also give me a hard time for how emotive I can be, kind of, you know, getting into the feels. And so the question emerges and he just looks back at me and he's like, oh, Mary, you would be Sappy Spice, because it hits the wood thing, it hits the feels thing. And then as far as the inextinguishable part, man, as far as being like kind of into the verbal stuff, I mean, I like to talk, I like to listen. Inextinguishable is a really rad word. I think it encompasses, right? Think like for a thing to be inextinguishable, that like implies so much perseverance and these qualities that I hold dear. And so I'm inextinguishably sappy. It's an unshakable characteristic.
I love it. Okay, so to wrap up, there's one question I ask everyone. If you could have any superpower at all, what would it be and why?
I feel like there's a multitude, but instead of just ruminating too long, for some reason, music's coming into my mind. It would be really rad to just have a proficiency to pick up any instrument and run amok with it. And there's a universality in music, you know, that you could share that with humans all over.
Wow, that is a really good power to want. Like, I mean, that's incredible. I like that. And I like that universality, like part of it, that like you can convey that sappy emotional part of you to absolutely anyone through music. And like having that ability to just like, whether it's a guitar nearby or a violin or a piano or a banjo, you just pick it up. I don't know why I picked those almost all string instruments. You just, you know, harmonica, you pick it up and you go and you share that emotion. I love that. Okay, final question. But why does Mamacita love cards?
Oh my God. Well, can I count the ways? Mamacita love cart because reasons. They're so functional. They are so dumb functional. They are so their own. The multitude of fingerprints of carts and the shapes and colors and varieties they come in, they're precious. They're themselves and they're handy. And Mamacita love them.
I cannot wait. I literally, you have no idea. Like I am on a mission. I'm collecting as many iconographies of carts as I can. And I'm really sad to say that there's not enough of them that are actually industrial linked. So I think eventually I'm just going to start vector drawing them, because it is going to be a shirt. It's actually on the other shirt that it's a coming shirt. So like, this is going to happen. Yes. I'm keeping my promise. Luckily COVID is buying me time.
It's truly a thought I have where I'm out in the wild and I see a cart and I'm like, you're so great.
Yes, you're like, I love you.
I see you, cart.
On you?
You're can doing I, the thing.
Can I ride around for a little bit on you? Like
in the machine shop where I'm going to school, we have a whole gaggle of carts that live back in the drill press area. And I don't know, they have some shit ass casters and they're really loud on the concrete floors, but like, they're also really great. And our machinist toolboxes are heavy. And like, I'm not going to judge them. You know, they're doing the best they can.
They are. So I'm just going to, I have to tangent for a second. My very first big purchase as a design engineer for my vaccines company was I had to buy all of the carts for the entire facility.
How did you hold out on me this long?
It took, oh my God, you have no idea how long I was like designing and then assembling and like do all four of the wheels pivot? Is it just the front wheels? Is it just the back wheels? Are they made out of this material or that material? What kind of cleaner are you going to use? Like, especially
there is a deep philosophy now on actually like when does something become a cart, and like if it has casters, is it a cart?
Is it a cart?
I don't know. I'm really open. I kind of like to live in that liminal space where things don't have to be categorized in a binary fashion.
Yeah, I get that.
If you want to be a cart, you can be a cart.
You can be a cart. I might be a cart for Halloween or maybe tomorrow. I don't know. This has been amazing as always. I want to thank you so much for joining me on this maker journey. This is all still so new and fun. And I've really enjoyed this.
Same. Thank you for including me.
Awesome. That's it for Tinkering Bells. This episode is assembled and ready for delivery. But I couldn't possibly do this alone. It's support from sponsors and listeners like you that make this all possible. So I want to give you all a big round of applause. Thank you for choosing Tinkering Bells as your user's manual for all things maker on a near weekly basis. If you want to continue to hear more, don't forget to rate and review the show on your podcasting app of choice, as well as sharing it with your friends. I look forward to seeing you next week. Until then, don't forget to keep making.